I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins is a leading candidate for Carl Sagan's seat as chief popularizer of science. But Richard Dawkins' writings, from The Selfish Gene to The Blind Watchmaker, popularize a famously bleak, baby it's cold out there universe, an empty, accidental, random world where the vitality in your genes is about preserving them, not you. It's not a comfortable world for many readers, but Richard Dawkins wants us to get over it. His book, Unweaving the Rainbow, doesn't soften his earlier writings, but it does strive to show how the refraction and reflection of light by thousands of raindrops can retain wonder and beauty, maybe even mystery, without leprechauns or pots of gold or covenant implied. Rainbows are not his only target. The deep question here is, can we embrace the scientists' answer to mystery? Their answer being, we're working on it. Can we embrace that idea with all our hearts, our faith, even our imagination? Or as Richard Dawkins puts it, why is it so hard for us to imagine Beethoven writing an evolution symphony? Or to imagine a great poet's paean to the expanding universe? We're talking with Richard Dawkins this hour on The Connection about science in an age that still reaches for mystery and divinity. Connection listeners, does a selfish gene ruin your sense of self? Or can you still see a world of wonder in a grain of silicate? 1-800-423-8255 joins The Connection, a 1-800-423-TALK, The Science Connection, with the science writer Richard Dawkins, who joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome, Richard Dawkins.
Thank you very much.
You've got a beef with poetry in this book. The poets, you know, through the 19th century into our age, most of them don't like science, and the scientists, you say, write bad poetry, bad prose too. What's the problem?
I love poetry. I always have loved poetry, and I also love science. I started to love poetry earlier, and since I've come to love science, I've felt that poets are missing something in that they could be using science to be poetic. There are great poetic insights to be had from science. But as you say, in the 19th century, we did have poets such as Keats who were actively hostile to science. I'm not quite sure how seriously, but we are led to believe that Keats and Lamb belabored Newton at a famous dinner, the so-called Immortal Dinner of Benjamin Haydon. They attacked Newton for having destroyed all the poetry of the rainbow by explaining it. And as you said in your introduction, my belief is that it doesn't destroy the poetry, it doesn't destroy the magic in order to, when we explain it.
Well, for a lot of people, it dampens it. And a lot of the spirit of science has been to explain away mystery and magic. I mean, how does one retain both?
When you've explained part of the mystery, when you've solved one mystery, when you've solved one problem, you usually find that you've uncovered even deeper mysteries, even more magical mysteries that require solution. And then when you solve them, then there's something else to be discovered. But the act of solution itself is a wonderful, uplifting experience. Any great scientist tells us that. So there's magic both in finding the solution, and there's also magic in the remaining problems that it uncovers.
Yeah, give us an example. I mean, Darwin, evolution, or DNA science, for example, in which a resolution of one mystery opens another rather than closing off mystery itself.
Well, Darwin solved the mystery of existence, of human and animal existence, to the extent that we had a very good general solution to the great riddle. But he left open all kinds of details. And in the late 20th century, the last half of the 20th century, the molecular genetics revolution carried Darwinism to new heights of solution, new heights of inspiration. And I think that's quite a good example. And another example is
Forgive me if I may interrupt you. I mean, you say it left open lots of details. That's not what people want. They want a sense of greater awe, not just details to be swept up.
Okay, well, maybe Darwin wasn't such a good example then, but take Newton's Unweaving the Rainbow itself.
Okay.
Newton showed that white light decomposes into light of different colors. Now, in later times, that broadened out to the entire electromagnetic spectrum. So instead of just being the visible light from violet through to red, we now have the whole of the electromagnetic spectrum, X-rays at the short end, radio waves at the long end. Now, that's an enormous opening of humanity's eyes. Moreover, Unweaving the rainbow, spectroscopy, is the way that astronomers know what the stars are made of. You can't do a chemical analysis directly of stars. What you do is a rainbow analysis. You unweave the light coming from a star, and you can tell from a specific signature all the elements that are there. Unweaving the rainbow is also the key to knowing that the universe is expanding. When you look at very distant galaxies, the entire spectrum of light, the entire rainbow that's coming from distant galaxies is redshifted, which shows that the universe is expanding, and from that we can extrapolate back to discover when it started expanding, so we know roughly when the Big Bang was. We know how old the universe is, all from unweaving the rainbow. So what Newton thought he was doing was just decomposing light, white light into the different colors, and from that we now know what the stars are made of, we know how far away the galaxies are, we know the universe is expanding, we know how old the universe is. That's an enormous opening of vistas from a apparently small beginning.
Hmm. You refer to William Butler Yeats as your favorite poet, but he was also stubbornly anti-scientific. Can you imagine a conversation with him on this subject?
Well, I think it might be rather frustrating. He is my favorite poet, but in many ways he's maddening. I mean, he loved magic in the bad sense. He believed in fairies and all sorts of strange things. Automatic writing, spiritualism. In many ways, he wasn't my kind of man at all.
Why do you love him? I mean, that is part of the reason why people love him, as well as his being a genius with words.
I know. It's very frustrating. I suspect Yeats would be a lost cause for any attempt to convert him to science.
I just wonder, I mean, if you're letting the scientists off the hook too easily, why do people feel that science in general, and a lot of scientists in particular, are sort of incorrigibly reductionist? I'm thinking, I can't quote him precisely, but Steven Weinberg, the physicist, is quoted to the effect that, you know, when you know as much as he does about string theory and the actual construction of the universe, the whole thing looks rather pointless. That's exactly what people fear about science, I think.
Yes. I mean, and people have accused me of the same thing, and I've read Weinberg on this too. I mean, I've been accused of making life seem bleak and dark and pointless. I've even been asked, people have written me letters saying, how can you bear to get up in the mornings? And that's really why I wrote Unweaving the Rainbow. It is an attempt to answer that criticism. How can I bear to get up in the morning? I bear to get up in the morning. I long to get up in the mornings because I know I've only got so many years of life. And during those years of life, I want to open my eyes, open them wider, to understand before I die why I was ever born in the first place. It gives me an immense incentive to get up in the mornings, that I'm privileged, very privileged. You're privileged. We're privileged. We're all privileged to be here, to open our eyes for a short time. Most of the conceivable people will never open their eyes because most of the conceivable people will never even be born. We are very, very lucky to have been born. And we're even more lucky to have been born in the 20th century or now in the 21st century at a time when an incredible amount is known about the universe and about life. We have the opportunity to learn about why we're here.
But what about this risk that, you know, the more we know, the more meaningless it will seem in a scientific perspective?
Well, you used the word reductionism just now in a negative sense, and Weinberg uses it in a positive sense. I consider myself a reductionist in one sense, that I think that we want to understand complicated things by reducing them to their simpler parts. And that seems to me to be the only way, the only sane way, to understand complex things. It doesn't mean that you go right to the very, very simplest parts. It means you do it in a proper scientific way. Now, that's exciting. That's not bleak. That's not cold. That's a very, very exciting thing to do, to look at something complicated. And instead of just lying down and saying, oh, it's far too complicated to understand, I just revel it. I just bask in the mystery. It's much more exciting, it's much more uplifting to say, right, let's work this out, let's try to understand how it works, let's take it to pieces and look how the pieces work, and then put them together in our minds again and build up to the complexity. Now that's exciting, that's uplifting.
Let me ask, you complain, it seems to me in the book, that the whole culture is anti-scientific. Even though science has made our world, we keep running away from it. You make the point that people can get thrown off juries in this country, in the United States, for having a scientific education. And, of course, you can also get thrown off for being a journalist, too. And that you complain that, for example, X-Files, an enormously popular TV series, is sort of militantly anti-scientific. How serious is this bias in the culture, maybe in the beast, the human beast, against your great love?
Well, I think it is quite serious. I think it's probably worse in Britain. What I dislike about it most is that what people are missing, because it's not that I think that we all should become scientific for because it's useful or something. I just think it's a great cultural experience. The point about juries is a very special case. That's I think simply that lawyers would rather have jurors that they can browbeat, ignorant jurors that they can bamboozle. So that's I think a rather separate case. But what was the other thing you mentioned apart from juries? The
The X-Files. X-Files, in which...
I think that's more interesting because there, it seems to me, you've got a systematic, week after week, piece of propaganda in favour of inexplicable mystery. As I understand it, what happens is that each week there's some kind of a mystery and these two FBI agents are set to solve it. And one of them is biased towards a rational solution and one of them is biased towards some kind of supernatural in the broad sense solution. And usually, if not always, it's the supernatural solution that wins. And I think there's something relentless about that week after week. And the analogy I've used, which has given some offence, but I think it's a fair one, is imagine that you had a pair of police, a fictional series in which you had a pair of police agents who were trying to solve a murder or some serious crime each week. And every week there was one black suspect and one white suspect. And one of the detectives always was biased to suspect the black suspect, and one was always biased to suspect the white suspect. And lo and behold, week after week, it was the black suspect who did it. Now, that would be grievously offensive. That would not be allowed, rightly so. And it is not open to the defense, but it's only fiction. Of course it's only fiction. But it's fiction which, by this steady week after week bias, is turning into a kind of factual statement.
And you think sort of finding refuge in mystery is just bias? I wonder.
Well, I think in the X-Files it's bias. I think there's also bias on television show. I mean, television producers rather like programs about the paranormal. They certainly do in Britain, and I think they do here as well. And so they will set up what purports to be some kind of investigative show about... Well, it might be spoon bending, or it might be ghosts, or it might be astrology, or something like that. And they will go and interview a whole lot of crazies who believe in this stuff. And they will give them enormous airtime. There's tremendous power in having television time. And then they may switch over to a kind of token skeptic for often it's as little as 1 minute in an hour to refute that. And even 50-50 seems to giving equal time seems to me to be pushing it a bit, because it fosters the erroneous idea that if there's any kind of controversy, then the truth probably lies somewhere in between. Science has such a lot to say, and astrology and all these other paranormal things have so little to say that it doesn't even seem to me that they deserve 50% of the time, let alone the rather greater than 50% of the time they often get.
Connection listeners, is the truth out there? Is it in here? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 with the science writer Richard Dawkins. His new collection of essays is called Unweaving the Rainbow. I just want to throw you one more question before we go to callers. It's about a book written by an American journalist, Robert Wright, called Non-Zero. Seems to me he really throws a provocative question into the sort of random evolution notion. The whole point is, his whole point is that there is a bias in evolution toward the players of non-zero games at the cell level, at the plant level, at the animal level. Animals like us, of which we're the supreme example, human beings, that can cooperate, share, intelligence, thrive. And that gives a look, a long look at the Darwinian, at the whole evolutionary process, a kind of pattern, a kind of direction. In the arrow points toward intelligence. It points toward humanity. I wonder if you're familiar with the book and want to deal with the argument.
The book has only just arrived in Britain, so I haven't read it. I have read reviews of it. I am familiar with non-zero-sum games, and I can imagine what the thesis might be. I'm surprisingly sympathetic towards the view that there is a kind of progressive arrow in evolution. That's unfashionable among scientists now, and I'm one of the minority, and I gather that Robert Wright is another, who feel that there is some sense in which there is a progressive arrow of time in evolution. And I can sort of see what he must mean by the non-zero-sum game point. It's a thing I've written about quite extensively myself, though probably in a different way.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255 makes the science connection with Richard Dawkins. 1-800-423-TALK. Ken is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island.
Good morning, gentlemen. Chris, this is Ken Miller from Brown University.
Ah, author of Darwin's God?
That's exactly right, and I was on your program a few months ago and had a very nice discussion. Professor Dawkins, you and I met once at the meetings of the American Society for Cell Biology.
Yes, and I'm half... Sorry.
Sorry, where you were giving the public keynote address a few years ago.
I remember. I'm halfway through your Finding Darwin's God. I want to congratulate you on it. I think it's brilliant. I think it will become the book that I want to recommend to creationists whenever they bother me. Because
but this is it's a believer's book. It's a
Well, I haven't got to the end of the book yet, and I'm fascinated to know. I mean, it seems to me that this book, Finding Darwin's God, may be religion's best shot, because you, Dr. Miller, are... You convince me overwhelmingly that you're obviously a very clever man, and frankly, that's quite rare among deeply religious people. And
well,
so I'm really looking forward to the end of the book.
Well, I was going to say I feel at a disadvantage. I wanted to say the nice things about you first. first of all, I want to say two quick things. One is I heartily endorse your thesis that science deepens our sense of wonder and mystery and understanding of the universe. And I don't know if you're familiar with him, but my favorite poet, although I love many British poets as well, my favorite poet is Walt Whitman. And when I teach in the spring, I take a turn at teaching the freshman biology class here at my university. And I read a poem by Walt Whitman called The Learned Astronomer. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it essentially describes Walt Whitman's aversion, basically, at scientific knowledge. And I read that poem, and then I warn my students, I don't agree with that at all. And I take an entirely opposite view, and I think your book on Weaving the Rainbow is exactly in the same vein.
I'll look that poem up.
At that meeting, at the cell biology meeting, you took up what's called the biochemical challenge to evolution by a fellow named Michael Behe, who is a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University here in the U.S. And Behe argues that evolution cannot explain, I'm sure you know all about this, the evolution of biochemically complex structures. And you urged the scientists at that meeting, darn it, you people know cell biology and biochemistry better than I do. Why don't you get out and answer answer Behe's arguments? And in my book, I've given Behe a whole chapter and tried to take his arguments apart piece by piece. And at least that's in part due to your inspiration. But here's what I really wanted to ask about. I have been very active in the anti-creationist movement in the United States. I'm delighted that you find my book useful in that direction. I'm also the co-author of a high school textbook that is widely used among high schools in the U.S. and is frequently, because it has a strong treatment of evolution, the target of criticism. And when I go out and talk to school boards and state committees and so forth, one of the things that happens to me again and again, and you may be disturbed or flattered by this, is that the words of Richard Dawkins are thrown back in my face. And specifically, I try to argue that evolution is a scientific theory. In fact, as Daniel Dennett has said, maybe the best idea that anybody has ever had. But the people who are concerned about it have two kinds of objections. One are scientific, and those turn out to be very easy to answer. And then the other types of objections to evolution are philosophical. And what they argue is that evolution really isn't science. Instead, it's a philosophy, an ideology, and a form of secular religion. And to buttress their case, they quote from you.
Yes, I'm aware of that, and I think that's very unfortunate. I'm having trouble with my headphones because they're giving me an echo of my own voice, and so I'm trying to get rid of the sound for a bit. I agree that tactically it is unfortunate that the kind of things that I say about religion can be used by redneck creationists to attack evolution, because the real battle is a scientific battle, and it's one that you are fighting and I am fighting on scientific grounds. And I'm aware that for me to take the stand that I do, which I definitely do, that there is something deeply incompatible between evolutionary science and religion is playing into the hands of certain kinds of creationists who are able to say, you see, we told you so, this evolution really is an anti-God move.
Exactly so.
And so I think that for tactical reasons, it's probably better, at least in the United States, for me to shut up.
Unfortunately, sir, your books speak for themselves, and you know, you wondered, I think earlier in the show, why people think that science makes life seem bleak, dark, and pointless. I'll quote you something that you wrote in your own book, a marvelous book, incidentally, called River Out of Eden. You wrote on the basis of evolution that the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference.
Yeah,
and
I stand by that.
It's an extraordinary statement. I don't regard
it's not extraordinary. It's
statement, but as a philosophical one.
No, that is an absolutely correct statement. I stand by every word of that statement. All I was saying was that it might be tactically the wrong thing to do if you are fighting in the trenches in the United States, trying to stop the education system being ruined.
Sure,
now, in Britain, it's not like that. In Britain, we can just believe it. We can just say what we believe, because it doesn't get turned around into a battle to subvert children's education.
Well, Richard, I know there are other callers, and I'll just leave with one point, and that is, I understand your point about it being tactically not the thing to emphasize, but I would also suggest, and I'll certainly let you answer this and then go on to other callers, I would certainly suggest that it's also philosophically the wrong statement, because as Ian Barber puts it, both scientific materialists and scientific creationists fail to respect the proper boundaries of science. And what Barber said is the former makes statements about religion as if they were part of science. And I think that's what you do. And then the latter makes statements about science that are dictated by religious beliefs. And that's what the creationists do.
I will defend vigorously my tendency to make statements about religion as though they were a part of science. The way the vast majority of people treat religion, it is a part of science, because the vast majority of people who are religious believe in miracles, they believe in the virgin birth, whatever that particular religion happens to be. They believe that water turns to wine, or wine turns to blood, or whatever it is. These are scientific claims. They believe that Jesus had no earthly father, for example. Catholics believe that, and many Protestants do as well. Now, what is that if that's not a scientific statement? That is a specific statement about something that is supposed to have happened in this world 2,000 years ago. Now, that is a scientific statement. And religious people who hide behind a smokescreen of saying, oh, religion has nothing to do with scientific things, entirely separate domain, philosophically unsound to even mention it, they are having their cake and eating it at the same time, because they are deriving the benefits of the recruiting potential of miracle stories, which are scientific stories. They're violations of scientific principles. Those have enormous recruiting power. So when talking to simple people, you get them into the churches by telling them miracle stories. Then you turn around and talk to sophisticated philosophers, and you deny that you are in any way encroaching upon the territory of science. That's hypocrisy.
Well, you know, Ken Miller would answer this better than I, but respond. it just seems to me, though, that the scientist in this case, you, Richard Dawkins, is being more fundamentalist, more literal-minded than the religious people. I mean, I think of the Galileo example. David Sobel reminded us in a new book from his correspondence with his daughter. But he was adamant in his science. He was adamant in his religion. He could look at the heavens and see, as he said, the work of God. He could read the Bible and the work of God. He could look at the Bible and see the word of God. And he perhaps compartmentalized a little bit, but he could cling to both in different modes of his mind. I wonder what's, for some religious people and for some scientific people, what's so hard about thinking on two planes?
Well, I think it would be very easy to answer that, but I want to come to the defense of a certain kind of religion, Einsteinian religion, which is not a religion in the normal sense at all, but which is an expression of poetic awe and wonder at the universe, at the laws of physics, at biology. I'm religious in the Einsteinian sense, and I think an awful lot of scientists who call themselves religious are actually religious in the Einsteinian sense. And I have no quarrel with that whatever. That's absolutely fine. What I do have a quarrel with is supernaturalism. And supernaturalism seems to me to be utterly unscientific. I can't believe that Kenneth Miller would disagree with that. Supernaturalism is the very antithesis of science, and I don't believe that any sophisticated scientists or indeed theologians are really supernaturalists.
Stand by for a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection with the scientist and science writer Richard Dawkins. His new book of essays is called Unweaving the Rainbow. It's about science, delusion, and the appetite for wonder. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Eben is calling from Iowa City, Iowa.
Hello. Oh, this is Welcome. A wonderful opportunity. I've been thinking a lot about issues that Mr. Dawkins has put forward for quite some time, and if you'll allow me to spin out a complicated question, I could get at this thing that's been, you know, on my heart for some time.
Let me understand it, and then everybody will understand it.
Certainly. I'm director, by the way, of Digital Worlds at the University of Iowa in the School of Art and Art History, developing a new digital art program. And we're very involved in issues of collective communication via the Internet and virtual worlds and this sort of thing. And it comes up constantly, this question of communication as being a kind of living event, which is shared by many earnest, wiggling inputs, and this stress on a kind of a community event for communication is important to me vis-a-vis science. Science is also a communication event, but often kind of poses as an objective event, as if we were above the world looking down. And it's interesting because when one takes on that participatory approach, something which I think everyone from Thomas Kuhn to Michel Foucault have discussed as part of the politics of science, you no longer can quite have the arrogance about what science is about. And I think that there's some interesting contradictions in Dawkins' work when he talks about memes on the one hand and, you know, this kind of universe we observe having nothing but blind, pitiless indifference.
Sharpen the question about memes. Memes being a Richard Dawkins coinage to describe ideas that take on a life of their own, sort of ideas that become viruses, in effect.
Right.
Good viruses, perhaps, too. What's the conflict between memes and a blind universe?
Well, the idea of a meme, is that, as you're pointing out, is that it's a thought gene. It's based on the Greek word for memory, memesis. And it suggests that all of our thoughts, all of our communication evolves along with organisms in a very similar fashion, except instead of taking place in an environment, a particular physical niche, it takes place in the environment of the mind. That very theory suggests that mind, what we are presently slithering about in with no absolute proof of, is, it's an attempt to objectify something subjective. And there are these contradictions there, and it takes a while to kind of pin it down.
I want to give Richard Dawkins a bite at it, Evan. Do you see, do you take the question? Do you acknowledge
I'm it? Let me put it this way. I think that science is a very social activity. There is a community of scientists who are all, in a sense, working on the same thing. So unlike any other branch of culture where you can talk about, shall we say, Indian culture or Japanese culture or American culture, we don't do that with science. I mean, of course, there is Indian science, there is Japanese science, there's American science, but science gets better as it becomes more and more the same across different cultures. There may be insights that different cultures can bring, but all scientists pay lip service to the view that there is some kind of objective truth out there, which it is the business of all of us to work together towards achieving. And that's actually quite different from art or from music or from religion or any other branch of culture. Now, I don't see the contradiction with memes. Memes is what I see when I look as a biologist, as a sort of rise above humanity and look as a biologist at humanity and try to make sense of some of the things that go on in culture. And so the memes that spread through a culture might be scientific memes, they might be religious memes, they might be artistic, they might be fashionable, they might be musical. And one is not there making any pronouncement about whether they're true. They are just simply that which spreads. Some things spread, some things don't spread. And as a biologist, you can study that in the same kind of way as a population geneticist studies the spread of genes. But as a scientist, I would say that science is a sort of international cooperative enterprise which aims to establish an objective truth.
Evan, do you want to follow up?
Well, yes. The point is that if we are guided by memes, and this very conversation is guided by memes, then in effect we're not really free, and nor are we actually objective in this very conversation. We're simply puppets being manipulated by something we're presuming to be out there. And if we are thus being manipulated, we can't even make the statement that those memes exist.
One could have said that long before memes. One could have said that about any sort of materialistic interpretation of the human mind. If a scientist says that he believes that that the human mind is governed by molecules in neurons and ionic potentials and things, or if a geneticist says that that development is governed by genes, that clearly manifestly doesn't actually stop us having thoughts and trying to work out the very things that we're talking about, the molecules, the genes, the brains. It does seem that the human brain is capable of understanding something of the nature of its own working, even though at the same time it is pinning down that working to molecules, genes, or memes.
Evan, thank you for the question. Richard Dawkins, stand by. 1-800-423-8255 makes the science connection with the writer Richard Dawkins. Phil is on the line.
Hi, this is another great show, Chris. Congratulations.
Thank you, Phil.
I want to talk about religion. I think that one has the danger of falling into an almost religious form of materialism in which all other forms of faith are lumped into one sort of superstitious mass. And I would posit that a religion like Buddhism, in contrast to what your guest seems to think of as religion in general, is in fact an evolutionary religion which would acknowledge all the physical data that you have presented and then take it maybe one step further, that we as human beings, our minds or souls or what have you, are in fact evolving, and we can take conscious steps to evolve them to higher states in this lifetime and also through several lifetimes. And if you're going to take a materialistic dispute with the idea that of, say, reincarnation, I would say perhaps you might apply the conservation of energy and matter to a conservation of awareness. Why would you posit that awareness would definitely end? You cannot prove it. So this is a religion that is very scientific in nature, and yet rather than being depressed by the sort of, you know, overwhelming complexity of the universe, it takes it, looks at its interconnectedness and says, well, what's really important here? It's the intention. What is your intention? It doesn't matter all your data. Your intention. Do you wish to benefit other beings or don't you?
Richard Dawkins, how do you deal with Buddhist piety?
Yes, and I apologize for lumping all religions into one supernatural basket. That was the wrong thing to do. On the other hand, it is significant that religions are so diverse, and that's the very point you're making. They are so diverse, and therefore it isn't obvious if you're a religious person which religion to adopt, and most people, as a matter of fact, tend to adopt the religion of their parents. The vast majority do, which I think tells us something in itself. But if there is a religion, and if it's Buddhism, that takes a more scientific point of view, then that's fine. It seems to me to be a roundabout way to do it. I mean, if you want to take a scientific point of view, why not just simply do that instead of calling it Buddhism? If you want to take a scientific view of the world, then study science. If there happens to be among all the world's smorgasbord of religions one which is a bit more scientific than the rest, then that's a good thing. But it's a roundabout way to approach it. Now, when you mention things like several lifetimes, when you mention things like reincarnation, when you say, how do we know that awareness ends? We don't know, but that, it does seem to me, is a classic example of what we were talking about earlier with Kenneth Miller. That is a scientific claim. The claim that awareness goes on after death is, I would not call that a philosophical claim. I would call that a scientific claim. It's either true or it's not true. I think that science gives us fairly good reason for thinking that it's not true. I think that science gives us good reason to think that awareness has a lot to do with the brain, that it develops during the lifetime of the individual from babyhood, from in the embryo, the brain develops and then it gets bigger. You become gradually aware. The awareness is a manifestation of the physical structure and physiology of the brain, and that seems to me to be fairly strong reason to doubt that awareness goes on after death. So that is a scientific claim, and I suspect that it's a wrong one.
Well, I wish Ken Miller were still here. I wanted to know why you admired his book, which is a religious book, after all, but in his absence, let me just put the question in my own terms. I was reading your book, Unweaving the Rainbow, and listening yesterday in another plane, I suppose, to Bach's St. John Passion, and this passage just leapt out at me. I don't see any difficulty in having in one lifetime, in one imagination, both a scientific respect and the religious view of the rainbow, specifically, that's made here in Bach's St. John Passion.
Well,
hang on, I just want to read this moment from the Passion, in which the tenor aria, this is Bach and his librettist adding to the story as written by St. John. Mark how his bloodstained back, its every welt, is lifted high as heaven, for which, after the tossing waves of our ocean of sin are calmed, the rainbow in its loveliness signifies God's grace. That's not science, but that is a human story refined by the artistic and spiritual masters of our culture, which seems to me at least as true as the science. Why not?
It's great poetry, and Bach is, I think, probably the greatest composer who ever lived. I love that poetry. I don't think it actually refers to anything real, but that doesn't matter. We discussed before, I also love Yeats. So you can appreciate poetry on that kind of level, but religion to most people is something very different from that. Religion to most people is a belief about the world, about the cosmos, and about life, which I think is false. And so that supernaturalism, the supernatural belief in religion, which is quite different from the poetic belief, which you can call religious and which I referred to as Einsteinian religion. I'm all for Einsteinian religion. I think it's simply confusion to lump it in with supernatural religion, where people actually do believe that Jesus never had an earthly father. Now, that seems to me to be an anti-scientific claim, and I believe that that should be attacked on the same sorts of grounds as spoon vendors and other people who are making false scientific claims.
1-800-423-8255 makes the science connection with Richard Dawkins. Linda is calling from Buffalo, New York.
Yes, good morning. I don't have a lot of credentials except the wonder of living. And, you know, I am somewhat college educated. But what I would say is that, first of all, to say that perhaps if there is a universal being that's God, perhaps he set us or she set us in motion to be challenged to learn and discover the world and the universe.
Well, that's a nice way to put it, and I think that one could say that it's a kind of poetic level, the same way as one uses, as Einstein was constantly invoking God for talking about the universe itself. God does not play dice.
I'm passionately interested in science and the arts. I mean, the whole spectrum of thinking and living and believing. The other thing I just wanted to say, as a mother, you know, having, you know, you talked about the wonder of really discovering and knowing something in terms of carrying a child. It was wonderful and miraculous, and I could feel every movement. But when that baby, now my children are grown, but when those children arrived in my arms, it was even more wonderful and miraculous to breastfeed them and know that they were growing and then how they learned things. And to me, that validates what you say in my simple way of thinking, you know.
Good. Well, yes. I mean, I think that's wonderful. Good.
So that's all I wanted to say, and I've enjoyed hearing you, and I love the connection. It's great.
Linda, thank you. We love listening to you. 1-800-423-8255, The Science Connection with Richard Dawkins. Adam is on the line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say I think the guest is spending a lot of time addressing one of the least important parts of theology. You know, I guess in contrary to his assertion that most religious people focus on the supernatural aspects of religious traditions, I would argue that, you know, the real value of these traditions is in the language they give us to discuss ethical issues. And science can never do that. Excuse me. So, you know, like with Passover coming up and the Christian holidays of the coming week, I think it's interesting that the conversations most of us will have around the Seder table, for example, will focus on what it means to be free or what it means to pursue liberation. We're not going to really, at least most of us, won't spend a lot of time talking about whether or not the Red Sea really parted, because that's not what matters in our daily lives. Regardless of whether that happened, we still need to figure out how to live a good life.
Yes, and I think that's right. I mean, when you say regardless of whether that happened, I think it does matter whether that happened. But when you say that science can't provide any ethical framework, I agree with that, and I don't think that science should. I would hate it if we got our ethics from science. I would also hate it if we got our ethics from religion, as a matter of fact, and we don't, of course. We pay lip service to the idea that we get our ethics from religion, but if we really got our ethics from religion, then we'd still be stoning adulteresses to death, we'd still be punishing people for the sins of their grandfathers. We don't do that, and the reason we don't do that is that we have a kind of general liberal consensus of what is right and what is wrong, which has developed over centuries of political philosophy, political developments, of legal developments, which owe rather little to religion. Religion has contributed to that. But anybody who suggests that we need religion in order to have ethics, I think should actually read their holy books and see what would happen if you literally did take your ethics from them. And I don't think anybody would really want to do that.
I just can't resist the argument there. I mean, we get a lot of culture-specific laws out of religion which are not honored, obviously. But who's to say we don't get ethics, a sense of relation to each other, relation to God, out of a religion?
Well, we get them from a wide variety of places. Our whole civilization has developed these ethics. But if it were as simple as just getting them from religion, then religious people should be more moral than non-religious people, and there's no evidence for that. Quite the contrary. I mean, with very few tests that have been done. There was one experiment that was done, for example, on cheating in exams in American college students, and that they were set up in such a way that it became possible to cheat. The students didn't realize that their cheating was being watched. And the question was, did atheists cheat more or less than devout religious people? And the answer was that atheists cheat less. It was suggested that the reason they cheat less is that they don't need to cheat so much because they're cleverer and so can get higher marks in the exam in any case.
There's a question. Why do atheists cheat less than religious people? It's too deep. But it's plausible. 1-800-423-8255. Rick is on the line.
Chris, and St. John's Passion is a flashback from last week, and that's the one I'd go with, frankly. Jesus knew what he was doing the whole time. Anyway, Professor Dawkins, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I am, in fact, a professional physicist. I'm actually working in cluster physics, which is pretty much at the forefront of all kinds of interesting areas. But I also had the benefit to have my middle graduate education in theology. In fact, I studied evangelical Calvinism, and that was pretty much my major there. So I've actually had the opportunity to see both sides, and quite frankly, data is data, and one lives by it, or one is fooling oneself. Theology is also referred to as the queen of the sciences, and for good reason. If you're interested in ethics, I'd suggest you read a little bit of Helmut Thielicke, a German theologian who was really a specialist in ethics. But basically, what I wanted to comment on was the fact that I think, having heard a lot of people who were evolutionists decrying you and Behe and so forth, and having heard a lot of science types, yourself included, as you just mentioned a few minutes ago, decrying theology and religion and ethics, it's my considered opinion that if, in fact, both sides spent more time trying to understand each other a little bit more rigorously, I think an awful lot of the arguments would disappear. And I've just finished a book that I'm doing a review on for the American Scientific Affiliation called Electromagnetism and the Sacred, published by Continuum, by an author named Lawrence W. Fagg, F-A-G-G. And what he is positing here, he's a Catholic theologian, actually Catholic physicist who taught at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. And what he's positing is that, in fact, if you really study quantum physics quite carefully and study theology quite carefully, there is, in fact, a remarkably interesting potential bridge between the two. God does not play dice, but he also lets us live by free will and grace.
Rick, I want to give Richard Dawkins the last word here.
Well, can I recommend another book? But
sure.
Unfortunately, I can't remember the title, but the author is Victor Stenger, S-T-E-N-G-E-R, and he is a professor of physics in Hawaii, and he has written a book on quantum theory arguing exactly the opposite point of view, and I wish I could remember it, but the word quantum obviously comes into the title. So that's Victor Stenger. I do warm to the suggestion of your caller that scientists and theologians should spend more time studying each other's works, except that I don't know which theology to study. I mean, there is one science, which is the science that all over the world scientists are working towards, as you know. But theology, do you mean Catholic theology, Islamic theology, Hindu theology, ancient Roman theology? They're all different. How do you know which one? There's potentially an infinite number of theologies that you could study. How do you know which one to go for?
We're going to have to make several more connections on it. We'll do an Islamic theological connection with science, or a Christian, or Buddhist, or Hebrew, or Jewish, whatever. Richard Dawkins, this is just wonderful fun, and thank you for plunging with us. We had help today from John Hoder, Dan Monty, Glenn Alexander, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hathi, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Coming up next on Here and Now, a live report from Hopkinton and the start of the 104th running of the Boston Marathon. We're funded.